This is the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, it's been a momentous week in British politics, hasn't it? Parliament voted on Wednesday night to approve airstrikes in Syria, whilst Labour held Oldham West and Royton last night with a convincing majority of around 10,000, with the vote share being increased, much to the surprise of many political commentators. But what does it all mean, and what do we make of the state of the Labour Party as we move into 2016? And how much influence should polling, whether done well or badly, have on the kinds of foreign policy decisions that politicians have had to make this week? Today I'm joined, as ever, by Rob Vance. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, good to be here, Kieran.
And our guest today is Peter Morton, who has an impressive CV. He was former head of press and broadcasting at the Labour Party and worked for the Ministry of Defence on Iraq and Afghanistan and communications issues around those, which is obviously very relevant this week to do with when we're thinking about Syria and military action. And he's also the Cabinet Member for Public Health, Adult Social Care and Voluntary Sector, and the voluntary sector for the London Borough of Haringey, obviously Labour. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here, Kieran.
Guys, I think it probably, if we start off briefly by getting your sort of quick-fire reactions to last night, obviously we'll talk about that in a bit more detail later on the podcast, but I guess, Rob, I'll start with you. I mean, this wasn't a result that the political commentators expected. What's your reaction to last night?
Well, no, I think it's interesting to see that the turnout game, as ever, has proven to be particularly important. Postal votes clearly being cited as Farage, and maybe we'll talk about that a bit later. But I think, you know, a well-organised campaign in a by-election by a team of people who know what they're doing clearly gives you a different result to the one that lots of commentators wanted to look for, given perhaps what the national picture is.
Peter, what do you think? I mean, your work in the Labour Party, presumably people within within Labour will be quite pleased today.
I think definitely it's a very strong result. Normally you wake up the morning after a by-election, or rather you wake up in the middle of the night just after a by-election, and you look at things and you're thinking, right, so how can we just about cut these numbers so that we can demonstrate that we've held up our share of the vote and we're making progress? And personally, I probably thought Labour would do it by 2,000 or 3,000 because it just had that kind of feel. Didn't think it was ever in doubt. But to see us, I think, increase our share of the vote, to see really quite big numbers for a time of year where people do not want to go out and vote is really quite striking. And I think it's quite interesting for what it tells us about UKIP too. Sore losing is frankly an understatement for their reaction.
There's quite serious allegations being thrown around, isn't there, about sort of postal vote fraud. And obviously these are serious issues, but I mean, I would imagine that if you think this is true, you ought to have some proof for that.
I think it's very courageous of them to be going out quite as forcefully as they were doing in the middle of the night, and maybe in the cold light of day they'll step back from, frankly, what is a very silly set of things to have said. I think there's a lot of confusion that can come in around postal votes, where ultimately you see large postal vote numbers generally, or large strong performances for Labour on postal votes in by-elections, because it's something which is really very well worked into the campaign strategy, that you make sure that people who are going to support you are going to turn out and vote.
And you know who those supporters are. I mean, this is the thing that UKIP struggle with, as a party that doesn't necessarily have the local infrastructure to know exactly who its voters are, and to make sure that 6 weeks out from a by-election, they've all been canvassed, that they all know that, you know, to go to do a postal vote. I mean, you know, I think I'm right in saying, Pete, that I'm not sure quite, the rules keep changing on these kind of things, but certainly, you know, many times you would say, you know, you tell people to do a postal vote if you're a solid supporter, because that means that on the day you can focus on getting out the more marginal voters, the swing voters, the people that you need to turn out and work hard to make sure that they're going to the polls, rather than having to focus on turning out your base on the day. So, I mean, it makes complete sense in terms of the pragmatics of a campaign, but it's something that you're not able to do if you're essentially flying in your national team to then sort of start from more or less from scratch on day one, given that I suspect that in the general election in May, this would not have been a high priority seat, and there wouldn't have been a lot of resources, there wouldn't have been a lot of voter ID for UKIP, and so the mechanics of the campaign are then difficult. And I think we often talk about the Labour vote being soluble. You know, it absolutely poured it down with rain yesterday. But I think actually, arguably, what that does is it depresses turnout, and if you've already turned out your base with the postal vote, then the rain doesn't matter.
Let's come back to Oldham, because I want to talk a bit about, obviously, not arguably, in my opinion, the big news this week was obviously Syria. And it felt to me that polling played quite a significant sort of role in this debate. We had the YouGov polling out that shows support for airstrikes that seems to be significantly waning within the space of a week. And I'd be interested to get your guys' thoughts on that, because I suppose, on the one hand, that seems like Jeremy Corbyn's message is cutting through. On the other hand, maybe that's just the Paris terror attacks being a bit further away in the people's memory, and therefore, obviously, that initial bump maybe has receded. But I'll get your thoughts on that in a moment. But also, we've got a few other maybe sort of less scientific polls around the Labour membership consultation. And, you know, people on Twitter doing Twitter polls that show everyone backs Jeremy Corbyn over David Cameron on this issue. Before we talk about the issue and its substance specifically, I mean, what do people think about the role polling's played in this debate? Because it seems to me that, you know, public opinion is important, but it should only be so relevant to a debate like this. I mean, Peter, what do you think?
I think if you look at the way the discourse has been in the last week, it's very much shaped not necessarily by what's being put in front of Parliament or what the situation in the region is currently, but how people feel about and perceive Iraq and Afghanistan and other events over the last 10 years. And I think that's why you're seeing it play such a role in the way that it's being reported, that people are saying, well, what do the public think? Mm. What are the public telling their politicians to think or telling their politicians they think they should do? You get to a place where the politicians really haven't been leading in the same sort of way as perhaps they should be or would have done in previous years, I think. And you've seen space in the airtime on TV and radio broadcast, which has to be filled. Polling is a good way to fill it, and it's a way to have that debate.
I mean, Rob, what's your take on this? I mean, obviously, there seems to be a waning in public support for the airstrikes. How important do you think that is moving forward? Obviously, it's politically important for the Prime Minister if that continues to happen.
Mm. Well, I think there's a shift. I think picking up on something that Pete was saying there, I think what's interesting is the difference in the tenor of the debate inside and outside Parliament. I think actually Parliament had quite a good week this week. I mean, I think it started off with a very dry and quite technocratic kind of debate about, so these 70,000 fighters, are there actually 70,000? Are they actually moderate? Are they a real force or not? You know, about sort of third order consequences of doing this. You know, the debate in Parliament was not the same as the debate outside, which was fundamentally one of, do you want to kill children or not? You know, but that's interesting, right? Because there's a very different dynamic going on. Whereas I think the debate this week ended, particularly with Hillary Benn's speech, with a much more impassioned and much more principled and less technocratic argument about why this was the right thing to do or not. And in fact, on the other side of the debate, you had Tory backbenchers who were making a much more sort of thoughtful kind of argument than some of those people outside against the war. So I think what's interesting is that interaction between public opinion and, if you like, the political elite in the country. And I think that's going to be the interesting thing going forward. I don't think there are that many people in the public who are likely to come round to a kind of, if you like, a Stop the War coalition kind of perspective on the war. I thought it was interesting, and this is in contrast with the Iraq debate more than 10 years ago, you know, the bishops in the Church of England, for instance, were saying, we think broadly, I mean, we're saying, actually, we're kind of in favour of this. You know, this was a sort of a more considered and more thoughtful worked out thing. I think that kind of place is an interesting way of thinking about, is there a coalition against the war? Well, various things have to happen. And so that will be the interesting thing of interacting with public opinion. It will be, if you like, the technocratic success or otherwise of the execution of the war rather than the principle of doing it in the first place that will be, you know, decisive.
I think for me too, there's a point where if you look at what was being proposed this week and the sorts of forces involved, you're talking about 6 to 8 tornadoes, potentially some use of typhoons, but not in huge numbers. You know, this is very different from 30,000 troops on the ground that were sitting in the Middle East prior to March 2003. And when you look at the really quite limited terms of engagement or what the RAF's already been doing in Iraq, it's something like 200 strikes in the last 18 months, 2 years, which is a significant amount, but it's not actually the sort of levels that you would have seen in either of the previous big operations. And so it's almost, to me, felt a little bit like some of the polling and the attitudinal stuff has reflected a story that's not really linked to what the sorts of numbers that we're talking about here are. I was thinking to myself, if say this was the late 1990s and we were talking about this sort of level of military resource going in, would it have made waves in such a big way?
And we'll come back to Labour in a moment, but it does feel like, I mean, one of the accusations that people have is that, particularly in the Labour Party, is that the decision whether to back airstrikes or not is almost as much about a statement on Jeremy Corbyn's leadership as it is about the actual military action itself, which is obviously a pretty serious sort of allegation to make, but there's probably a bit of truth in that, do you think?
Yeah, but I think it cuts both ways. So I think the media certainly interested in, I mean, that is a more, it is a more interesting story to the media that is to make it all about the leadership and Jeremy Corbyn. I think the accusations fly from both sides. I think moderates within the party will say that, Jeremy Corbyn supporters are threatening, if you like, centrist MPs with deselection and all the rest of it, unless they vote with the leadership. And on the other side, if you like, Jeremy Corbyn supporters will accuse moderates of using an issue of war and peace in order to give the leadership a bloody nose. And I think sort of both sides of that have probably got some not unreasonable points. I think I was quite surprised at the positions of a number of like moderates and people in the shadow cabinet who did vote against. But it was a free vote. And similarly, I think what's interesting is Hilary Benn, potentially, you could argue, you know, changing his position over the course of 2 weeks. I think that's interesting. I'm not sure he's necessarily accounted for that change of heart or perceived, or from my perception, change of heart over the last 2 weeks. But then made, you know, the speech of his political career on Wednesday night, clearly with some conviction. So I think disentangling the war and the leadership is actually very, very difficult in terms of, you know, whether anybody's really taking advantage of the situation or whether actually it's just a coincidence. I mean, I think arguably it was in Cameron's interest to make sure that, you know, this was the issue and to make the issue more about the Labour leadership than about the actual matter at hand. So I'm not sure that, in a sense, the Labour Party is necessarily fully to blame for anyone accusing it of using this terrible issue as a way of, you know, arguing about its own internal
and
stuff.
And the cynic would look at the Conservative MPs rapturously giving applause to Hilary Benn as maybe something that, you know, they'd be quite keen to do, not just because of the content of the speech, but just to sort of embarrass the Labour leader as well.
Oh, totally. I mean, the comparisons with Blair just continue, right? I mean, McDonald goes on the next day and compares him to Blair. I mean, what's extraordinary is, you know, how, you know, someone who even on retirement was one of Britain's more popular prime ministers has now become a sort of a complete bogeyman at every level within the sort of centre-left of this country. It's quite extreme.
I mean, let's move on to
the last person to be given a standing ovation by Tory MPs.
I suspect it's reasonable to suggest Labour MPs won't do that for David Cameron. Let's move on to Labour and last night, because There's a number of different things to talk about. Obviously, we've had our initial... I'll come to you, Peter, now. We've had our sort of initial reactions, but I suppose let's think about where this leaves the Labour Party, particularly after last night, but also after the week that it's had. I mean, to summarise some of the polling before we have that discussion, YouGov have had some polling out which has shown Jeremy Corbyn's personal kind of net performing well, performing badly rating to be minus 41, which is awful. I mean, and with David Cameron level, as essentially, so within sort of almost neutral rating, and the Tories 11 points ahead in the opinion polls. So that points to, I think that polling is backed up in other pollsters too. So that certainly points to what I would call, what Peter Kellner's called, the polling fundamentals not being favourable for Labour if we look into the longer term. And Ian Warren's had some polling out which he commissioned himself, which I think people have probably seen online, which suggests that, almost seems to suggest Labour being something of a spent force, which I'd be interested to get people's view on. I think his rationale is that, you know, the opinion of Labour supporters and the public are sort of wildly divergent. We do see from not just Ian's polling, but other YouGov polling, that Jeremy Corbyn has strong levels of support amongst the membership, but, you know, is seen pretty negatively amongst the public. And obviously we've had this emergence, if you like, of Hilary Benn as a result of his speech. I mean, Peter, what do you sort of, given all of those things, but also last night, I mean, what's your assessment of the situation Labour finds itself in? It feels like that, you know, particularly after last night, Jeremy Corbyn may be unpopular in the country, but he's pretty strong within the Labour Party.
I think there's a bunch of different things to unpick here, as you say, Kieran. The first, which cannot be forgotten, is that Over the summer, five people stood Jeremy Corbyn won convincingly, not just in affiliated unions and membership, but he won in the Labour Party membership as it stood then, and he won by a significant margin. And I think he won fair and square, and people have to say fair play to that. Where it leaves us is if you're looking at comparisons with the past with others, yeah, it looks very difficult and challenging for the next few years. If you read across from, say, where Ed Miliband was in terms of his ratings, or if you looked back to Kinnock, I think it shows there is a real big job of challenge. But we mustn't forget that Labour got 29% of the vote in May this year. So, frankly, I think probably whoever was the leader would have similar sorts of numbers being reflected in their polling. I think that where the party is now and for the long term is it's got a period of 2-3 years of space where it needs to fundamentally look at what its political economy is and what the purpose of the Labour Party is in knowledge-based economy, an economy where we're about to have the Internet things take over. There's potentially huge amounts that Britain can do and can export. I'm conscious I'm kind of rambling here, so I'm going to bring it back to the key point, which is I think that what we're seeing is that debate, actually, and we're seeing that played out either across airwaves or seeing it across the conversations that are being had in Labour Party meetings as well. Mm. I think if you look at Oldham last night, big chunk of it, you've got to say, impressive candidate. He's 35, 36. He's son of a truck driver who left school, didn't go to uni, but has then sufficiently turned his council around that he got given an MBE earlier this year because it's the most improved place in Britain. You've absolutely got
That'll
to
go
say,
down well with the Corbynistas, won't it?
I'm sure it will, yeah. I think you've absolutely got to say to Jim McMahon, you know, good candidate, and he'll be a very, very strong MP in the future. I think probably the most, the clearest thing that you can say about all of this is that there were too many years where any sort of internal discussion wasn't really on in Labour. Mm. And it was a courteous way that we came to that, but to begin with it was, we need to win elections, we need to become the government, and then it was, we need to win a second term and win a third term. And then as things were starting to slip away from us in the latter years of Blair and Brown's prime ministerships, it was, we mustn't show that we are not the party that had the support it used to have. We mustn't admit that. And then for the last 5 years, it was, we've got to all pull together and do our very, very best to try and make things happen and to get Ed Miliband into Downing Street. And all of that was for really laudable aims, but the outcome was we didn't have a conversation that we probably should have had 10 years ago.
So Rob, I mean, obviously Peter raises a very interesting and good point there. Whoever the Labour leader was at this stage, whether even if it was Liz Kendall in a parallel universe, who was a completely different side of the party, of course, would have found exactly the same challenges, which are very difficult for Labour if we look ahead to 2020. Labour's lost its heartland in Scotland. Obviously, there's a debate about how to win that back, if it's even possible to win that back. And I suppose if you were to concede that Labour is not going to be back to where it was in Scotland ever again, then the natural logical conclusion to draw from that is you have to do somewhat better elsewhere, notably England, to compensate for that. So there are huge, huge challenges there. They seem to have, you know, the election lost because, you know, of a sort of failure to convince the public that they're ready for government, that they're credible on the economy and so on. I mean, it's not necessarily realistic to think Jeremy Corbyn's going to sort of turn that round overnight, is it? But at the same time, his personal poll ratings do seem to be disproportionately bad in comparison to past leaders. And I think some of the stuff on defence in particular doesn't feel like that's going to help convince people that Labour's ready for government and that he's credible as a Prime Minister. So what's your assessment bringing this all together as to where Labour is? Because at the same time, as we said at the beginning of this programme, he is popular amongst the members, isn't he?
Well, certainly among some of the members. So the membership has changed quite dramatically. 30,000 people have left the party since Jeremy Corbyn was elected leader. More have joined, it's fair to say. But, you know, the party is, I think it's fair to say, its membership is evolving and changing and shifting. And interestingly, there are still he's still disapproved of by 23 or 24% of the membership, which is pretty high. Though admittedly, these are early days. I think what you've got to think about is like the trends that we saw in the 2015 general election that you went through there. I mean, there are essentially three core shifts potentially going on. You've got Scotland, you've got UKIP, and then you've got what I would describe as, you know, the sort of the Lib Dem Green kind of merger into Labour, the sort of realignment of the left, if you like. And in a sense, what we've seen is an acceleration of one of those trends, which is the Green and Lib Dem collapse. You know, we've seen support and migration of people that voted Lib Dem and Green in 2015 coming over to the Labour Party, which is bumping it up. But actually, you've seen really little or no movement in terms of unwinding the defection to UKIP. And I think it's fair to say that this by-election demonstrates that. I mean, it's pretty consistent. Yeah, the vote share's gone up a bit, but I put that down to differential turnout rather than, in a sense, winning back people that were voting UKIP in those kind of northern industrial post-industrial seats in 2010 and 2015. And then in terms of Scotland, we just don't know yet. Mm. I mean, I think it's very, very early to tell. There's an election there next year. I've seen no particular sign of a shift there. But of course, curiously, you know, in some ways, once again, the Scotland test is going to be an odd one for Corbyn, given that the leadership in Scotland is not particularly Corbynista. Kezia Dugdale is not on that side of the party. But again, she, in a sense, is different again from the membership, which voted in the Scottish Conference this year to, you know, oppose Trident and various other kind of more Corbynista kind of associated measures. So, you know, it's a complex picture. But I think what we're really seeing at the moment, to my mind, in terms of the grand kind of cephalological picture, is an acceleration of what I would call quite strong headwinds against, you know, Labour in 2020, given that, you know, the Labour Party was quite effective in 2015 in winning over Lib Dems and Greens. The cephalological benefit of that is more or less exhausted. You know, Horns and Wood Green pick up, you know, maybe in a possible world, though it seems even then it seems quite unlikely, you might pick up Brighton Pavilion from Caroline Lucas, though I think even that's unlikely. I think it'd be more likely that she, you know, they came to some kind of arrangement with her, you know. But the reality is, you know, you're not seeing the kind of trends that you would need to win Carlisle and Lincoln and elsewhere. And you've got one in four members of the party who I think were pretty active in Oldham and Weston are really important in terms of the institutional base and ability to actually win elections, who clearly are really quite dissatisfied with Corbyn's direction. Mm. It's interesting that you mentioned the Austerity Britain piece, because I think actually on that side of the equation, there's a lot more unity in the party. I think foreign policy is a far greater cleavage between what you might describe as the moderate and the more Corbyn wings. There is far more visceral loathing amongst both sides for the other side's opinions on those issues. Whereas I think even amongst many moderates, there's a feeling that, as Pete says, the political economy, the position on welfare, universal credit, on deficit spending, on infrastructure, on the kind of economy that we want, and actually how to respond to a quite different Osborne kind of agenda. I mean, you know, you talk about the spending review recently, probably more important for like Labour's political fortunes than otherwise. I mean, if you had a situation whereby whatever it was, you know, 5 million families that voted Conservative in 2015 were being faced with £1,000 or whatever a reduction in their, in a sense, their, you know, social security spending, tax credits, whatever else it would be, then maybe those numbers would be quite different. But they're not. Mm. So how one responds to, you know, Osborne's kind of sharing the proceeds of growth, not doing lots of the things which would be most politically unpopular in a kind of strictly economic kind of way, I think that poses a far greater challenge for the party, if you like, intellectually, and that actually issues of kind of foreign policy and how to respond to, as Pete says, you know, a legacy of 12 years ago is probably, you know, going to subside over time, or at least one might hope.
Of course, the unknowns there are who the Conservative leader is, and the Prime Minister is leading the Tories into the 2020 election, and what impact the referendum has. Obviously, there's always going to be events in a party. If we look back to the last Parliament, I'm reading Selden's book on Cameron. And you, one thing that strikes you as you're reading that is just the number of seismic events that took place.
But
in
the
last
Pendulum's part. A really good, really great point. I mean, I have no idea why they chose to launch it this week of all weeks. But all bar three Labour MPs came out in as part of the you know pro-EU in the referendum. I mean, if we talk about division, then you know the Tory party.
There's lots of unity there, isn't there, with Labour at least. I mean, Peter, I'll come to you. I mean, I suppose one of the things I've said this morning, because obviously with these by-elections, there's a tendency, in my opinion, to sort of overanalyse them a bit, you know, particularly in the 24-hour news cycle of social media and, you know, hashtag Cameron must go, etc. Like, there's going to be lots of poring over these numbers, but arguably the biggest challenge is in May, isn't it, with all the nationwide elections, London Mayor, Scotland, Wales, you know, and English local council elections. I mean, what do you think Jeremy Corbyn's got to show in May to be able to sort of solidify that leadership, if we think he needs to? Because obviously, as Rob's mentioned, you know, he's popular amongst the members, so it's really his leadership isn't really that imperiled at the moment anyway, is it?
So I think there are a couple of things for me, and you can take them as indicators of the broader next 5 years. I think whenever I used to go around the lobby in the run-up to local elections or just afterwards, you had to be able to say, yes, Labour's done well in London, but we've also done well in the English regions that have got different demographics. And generally, you know, you're looking at trying to make an argument that you've once picked up some of the towns in Kent where there are people who demographically would be traditional Labour voters, but you know, were Conservative voters under Thatcher and Mayor. Major came back to Labour under Blair. You need to be able to show that you've done a bit of good business in the Midlands or in some of the areas of the North West that are slightly more balanced in terms of class than actually the media makes them out to be. And you see that particularly in some of the swing seats in the North West. I think last night David Gawke was saying the Conservatives picked up 22 seats in that region at May. That kind of shows you that that's a much more balanced region than the caricatures think. So I think really that has to be something like that to be able to show an argument that the world is changing and the world and Jeremy Corbyn can become Prime Minister. I think if I was putting very bluntly, because I don't understand the numbers quite in as much detail as you guys, I would say he's got a bunch of challenges if the world is as it used to be. Clearly there's just the leadership, which is a proxy for voting intention in 5 years, generally. And that is enunciating a different style of leadership, which is perfectly possible to do in a, you know, today's society is very different from 5 years ago. It's hugely different from 10. And our ideas of what a leader is will change over the next 5-10 years as well. You've got to get to the right position on the economy, and you've got to get to a point where national security actually is not a political issue. It's not about doing well on it. The fact is that when both main parties are doing well on national security, it's not an issue because it's not a matter for debate. The last thing, which isn't polling, but I think is hugely important and comes out of the Comprehensive Spending Review, is money. At this stage in the Parliament, most of Labour's core HQ staff who do the writing policy, the writing speeches, running their website, running their press operation, this time 5 years ago, they were funded by short money, so taxpayer support for the opposition party to develop its policy. I don't know if that's the case now, but it would not surprise me. And until about 18 months from the end of the last Parliament, Labour was getting the bulk of its money actually from the taxpayer. Short money is going to be quite significantly cut back. At the same time, you've got the trade union movement under threat from an unfair trade union bill that is going to alter their ability to fund. It's quite simply the case that unless either the leadership can square that circle or find a new source of money, they won't be able to run the campaigns that you need to run in order to win an election.
Or do the heavy lifting on policy and thinking that you need to do in order to put a manifesto together when in opposition.
So I guess looking ahead then to 2016, to sort of to wrap this all up, it feels like, you know, after last night, and given Jeremy Corbyn's popularity amongst the members, his leadership feels safe for now. We haven't really talked about Hilary Benson, but maybe we can bring some of that into the closing remarks. But I'd just like to get a couple of minutes from both of you on what kind of things you're looking out for in 2016. and you know, whether or not you think you know Labour might face a leadership challenge. Rob, what do you think?
So I don't foresee a leadership challenge unless there is some kind of, as it were, new information, a scandal or whatever it might be. I don't think any kind of leadership challenge is going to be catalysed by, if you like, just the normal political back and forth and forces of policy and debate and so on that's going on. I think actually it will be it's underwritten, but I think in coming weeks it will be shown that actually, interestingly, the Labour Party managed a pretty massive schism with greater, I mean, perhaps in the ins and outs of it, tactically not necessarily brilliant, but actually managed to keep the party together, which might not have been predicted if you'd seen the forces arraigned against it 2 weeks ago. So I think it would need to be a pretty big scandal for any kind of leadership challenge in 2016. I think the thing to look out for in 2016 in terms of elections is London is a hygiene factor. I think, as Pete said, you know, for now, the best part of, you know, 15 years, Labour has been improving its position in London. The demographic shifts and changes make London more and more a Labour city. It makes Boris Johnson's victories, you know, all the more impressive in many ways. And Zach Goldsmith is a good candidate. But I think it would be, it's a hygiene factor for Labour. I mean, if Labour don't win the London mayoralty under Sadiq Khan, then that would be a massive blow for Corbyn's credibility. Signs of life in Scotland for Labour will be interesting to see if they come through. You know, some people are saying that it's possible that the Conservatives could outpoll Labour in the Holyrood elections. That would be an extraordinary thing to happen, but I think it's possible. I think Labour will probably hold on in Wales, but it'll be interesting to see to what extent that is true. And then, as Pete's saying, I think the local election results, looking at those kind of Trans-Pennine corridor where you'll be looking for signs of Labour being able to pick up seats off the Conservatives as being the fundamental thing that they need to be doing.
Peter, last word to you.
I think elections will be very interesting in me. I think Sadiq Khan will win. I wouldn't look for leadership challenges, certainly not from Hilary Benn. He's one of the most decent and honourable people in politics. And in my time working for Labour, he was one of the shadow cabinet members who you knew would actually, he would hear you out. And if he disagreed with you, he'd let you argue him round. He's not the sort of Francis Urquhart type figure. And I think anyone who's trying to put him into that box is mischief-making. I think for Labour next year, feels quite a long way off, but annual conference will be very, very interesting. And it will be a sign of whether we can say genuinely we are a party that's had a debate, that's having a debate, that's conducting it in all of the sorts of ways that Jeremy Corbyn has said he wants it to be conducted, honest, frank, but comradely. And we're a party that can build something new for the future. I think that I wouldn't kind of prejudge anything until we've seen how that's developed further. I think also on a tactical level, we have to find a way of not letting the Prime Minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer try and play national security cards or foreign policy cards whenever they're getting into trouble, which is, you know, if you were being cynical, which I try my very best not to, but you would say, last week we had a comprehensive spending review where George Osborne essentially made up £27 billion of magic money that might happen in the future in order to reverse a huge glaring policy error that he'd made earlier in the summer. This week we move on very quickly to significant important matters, but the sort of tenor of the debate and the way in which the Prime Minister has been in private expressing himself suggests that there's a lot more party politics to this than he'd like people to think.
Peter and Rob, thanks very much. That was the politicalbettings.com Polling Matters podcast. Big thanks to my guests, Peter Morton and, as ever, Rob Vance. Lots of interesting topics discussed there. Obviously, it's been a very, very busy week in Westminster with the vote for Syrian airstrikes and, obviously, the by-election in Oldham yesterday. If it feels to me that you know, Jeremy Corbyn's leadership is solid within Labour, whether you support or oppose that, the fundamentals are that the membership backs him. There was no disaster in a by-election last night, and all attention will now gradually turn to Christmas and the new year, and then obviously, of course, to next May's elections, and as Peter mentions, you know, the conference season. But let's not forget the Conservatives in all of this, of course, as well. David Cameron has an EU referendum, or terms of EU membership to renegotiate, and a referendum. There will certainly be movement on that next year. There will be a big debate in Scotland more generally about the future there. And obviously Labour has to sort of contend with all of those things and try and convince people it's a credible party of government. Can they do it? Well, Jeremy Corbyn's personal poll ratings look pretty poor. Historically, we've seen, with Ed Miliband, that seems to be a sort of precursor for not doing very well in a general election. But there is, of course, a long time to go and lots of events to happen. And we don't even necessarily know if Jeremy Corbyn intends to be that candidate in 2020. Only he really knows that. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under Creative Commons. Always keen to get people's comments and thoughts on the podcast. And if you are on iTunes, do subscribe. Rate, review, leave comments, as long as they're good, and you know, that does help us out a lot. And thanks for listening, and there'll be more Polling Matters podcast in the coming weeks, looking more in more detail at the EU referendum, but also into 2016 more generally. And thanks for listening.